Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:25 on, am I getting an echo?
Yes, horrible in here.
3:25 on February 20th. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Millet, Representative Sadler, Representative Reinbold, Representative Heron, and myself, Chair Olson. I believe we may have one other committee member coming in shortly. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn your cell phones off. And we have two items on the calendar today. You can leave that on.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, this one. For the record, the committee does have, we were the first committee to get iPads, and we're true believers now. And speaking only for myself, I've got every one of my committees on here. It's a lot easier than lugging binders around. But having said that, we have two items on the calendar today, House Bill 68 and House Bill 9. House Bill 68, we've got Representative Hughes here and Ginger Blaisdell. Both of you, or one of you, or all of you?
Both of us.
Welcome back. Just like we saw you last week.
Yeah, thank you. It's beginning to feel like home around here. Yeah, it's good to see you all. This, I'm Shelley Hughes, representing House District 8, Palmer, and I have my staff, Ginger Blaisdell, with me here today. And I did lug papers, don't have one on an iPad, so please don't hold that against me, Mr. Chair. HB 68 is a few years probably overdue, because we set corporate tax rates back in 1981. So it's been a few years. And Alaska levies a corporate income tax on corporations doing business in our state, of course. And it's a graduated tax. That means the rate increases incrementally with the amount of taxable income reported. And the rates are based on 10 levels. And currently, that top level is $90,000, and the highest rate then is at 9.4%. And just, you probably already know this, but that taxable income is, I did have some questions, is based on the federal taxable income, which would be the gross minus certain allowable deductions. And there are some modifications. And we do have the Department of Revenue and Tax Division folks online. If there are specific questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to answer those. But, so, what, HB 68 is a rational way to get money back in the hands of Alaskans. And we know that will in turn help us with, create a stronger economy and increase the possibility of stronger earnings and more tax paid in the long run. And as said before, they were originally established back in 1981. And what this bill will do will simply adjust those brackets based on the Consumer Price Index, so adjust for inflation. And the rate change is fair, because it incentivizes all industries, doesn't pick favorites. And these are C corps, so does not apply to LLCs, partnerships, or S corps. And we have 16,000 companies in Alaska, and about half of those are S corps, so those aren't even included. And we have about 5,000 C corps that this would apply to. The majority of those, and I'm not exactly sure what handouts you have, but there's one that has a chart that looks like this. It's entitled Legislative Research Services, the Research Brief. Which, by the way, it had, that refers to SB 7 in that handout, which is the companion bill. And if you look at that, you will see that most of the companies are, on the third page, are, most of the filers are making less than $10,000. So we have a lot of small businesses in the state. And the other bulk are middle-sized businesses. And so what this bill does, it does create some relief for those small and medium-sized businesses. And you might wonder why we have so few C corps. Well, those laws to establish the S corps and the other options, the LLCs, took place in the 80s. And so we have some small and medium-sized businesses that were established pre-1980 that are still falling under these rules. And And so it's long-time Alaskan businesses, family-owned business that it impacts. It does impact some larger companies, of course, that do business in and out of state. And that, by the way, is taken into account as far as it's only taxing them for the business that's done in-state. So I did get a question about that from a member in the House, so I thought I'd throw that in. But in the prior structure, the top, before you hit the 9.4%, the highest rate was $90,000. And with this bill would change that top rate to $222,000. So it basically expands the brackets. Those lower brackets. And as an example, under the current structure, I'm going to tell you the sample tax paid by a large company, a fairly large company, and a small company under the current, and then tell you the same thing with if this bill were to go into effect. As soon as I find it. Oh, here it is. A company making at $550,000 would pay about $47,700 in taxes under the current structure. That's a good-sized company. A small company making $45,000 a year would pay $1,250. Under the new structure, that same larger company that is making $550,000, it would pay just under $42,000 in taxes, so about $6,000 less. The small company, which the one that was making $45,000 under this structure, had paid $1,250, would pay about half that, $650. So you can see it is a pretty good thing for that smaller business. So I guess that pretty much is what I have to say, and I'm open to any questions. And
well,
I believe
for
this
the,
is a good
for the
idea.
People that are not at an LIO and are not in the room but might be watching us streaming video or listening to us, this bill has a zero fiscal note and is a two-page bill and has not received, my office has not received any calls on it against the bill. How about your office? Have you had anybody that is not supporting the bill call in?
We have not, Mr. Chair. In fact, we do have a letter of support from the State Chamber, the Mat-Su Business Alliance, and I'm...
And just today we got one from the Juneau Chamber of Commerce and also the Wasilla Chamber of Commerce.
And I believe they're all part of the record, which is also nice about having them on iPads. Looks like the first question is from Representative Millett.
Thank you. Representative Hughes, can you tell me, we had looked at doing this, I think, a couple years ago, and one of the things that I found really confusing about our corporate tax structure is that we have so many brackets. I've looked at other states that have the three tiers, four tiers, but none that have as many as 10 tiers like we do. So is there a reason why we don't make the brackets broader so we have less brackets so it's not as confusing if you go, you know, from one bracket to another? I mean, there's so much bracketing that you know, every year you would be, may or may not be in a different bracket. And so I guess one of the simplicities that I have seen is that, you know, a three-tiered bracket, even though you might adjust the corporate tax for bigger and smaller companies, if you keep them in small, medium, and, you know, medium to large companies, it just seems like a much easier way. I mean, I looked at some stats from NCSL, and one of the things that they say is that this is burdensome for companies. So did you look at bracketing and smaller?
Thank you for that question. It's a good question. And talking with the sponsor in the other body, we did discuss that. And I think this was to basically make it very simple as far as the statutory change in just changing those numbers and not creating another whole system at this time. But I didn't actually have the conversation with the Department of Revenue that she may have had on that. So could we refer that to we have Joanna Bales and Robin Wilson online. Okay, when we go to them, I suggest that we give them that question. Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
First of all, thanks for bringing this to the table, Representative. I think it's great. Anything we can do to get us off the 50th spot to be a more friendly place to do business, I think that's really good. But I have a couple questions. In regards to this, what type of businesses would be in the C category? Is it typically restaurants? I'm just trying to figure out the industries overall, or is it pretty broad spread?
It is pretty broad spread, and the Department of Revenue could tell you more specifically, but because it didn't exist, that was the only option before 1980, any long-time business could be virtually from any industry, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and as a follow-up, okay, so what I'm trying to figure out is who assesses these taxes, because every now and then I'll go to a small business. I don't know if it's an LLC or whatever, unless I go look at the license, but every now and then I get annoyed because they bring up zero in the till when I'm handing them money, and I'm just wondering, is that a state issue? Is that a federal issue? You know, if you perceive that a company's consistently, you know, ringing up zero in the till, let's say it's at a nail salon or something like that, who investigates that type of, and is this the kind of business that's typically a C? And I'm sorry, this is just new, the C thing's new to me, so I'm trying to figure this out.
What, are you talking about the till has no cash in it? Are you talking about sales tax on your receipt?
No. I'm talking like if I get my nails done, let's say it's $35 and you ring it, and then at the till they ring zero. Up in the till, and that just every now and then I'm just wondering, who is that a state level issue? You know, who does this? And then, I mean, is there a state department? Is it the Department of Revenue?
Yeah, you know, the tax division does have investigators. I've never actually seen that, so
that'll be one of the questions we can ask her later on.
Okay, and then the second. Obviously, if people aren't paying taxes, someone else is going to bear the burden. I mean, if we continue the services, I'm just trying to figure out where this is going to shift to.
That is an excellent question, because many folks who are conservatives, I'm a conservative myself, we talk about lower taxes, mm-hmm. increases, you know, strengthens the economy so that you can help businesses. So in the end, mm-hmm. you hopefully would have more taxes coming in by growing businesses. And so, of course, that is part of the idea. The other, in the meantime, the hope would be that you tighten your belt. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one option. As far as the 3.8 million less in revenue, mm-hmm. I haven't heard any particular place where that would be cut. But as a legislature, since we're the appropriating body, that we would need to look at doing that. And 3.8 million in the overall state budget is quite small and doable.
Representative Sadler.
Oh, no, thank you. No question.
Bob? Or Representative Herron?
Thank you, Chairman Kao. So I guess, Chairman, this is more of a question for probably the smartest person in the room, Joanna Bales, but could, when it's appropriate, could we ask her, is there an unintended consequence here, in her opinion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson. I say Andy, but I can't do that.
Mr. Chairman, maybe this is for you. Maybe you can edify me. This is called a zero fiscal note, and I assume that's because it costs the state no outlay, but we know
to administer,
but we know it's going to cost, it's a loss of 3.8 million revenue. I mean, that's what the fiscal note says.
Yeah.
But yet we call that a zero fiscal note. Is that?
That's because it measures what the direct cost is.
I guess
you'd be staffing extra expenses to Department of Revenue. If there were two or three other departments that were impacted by it, you know, maybe a different kind of bill, you could conceivably have three, four different fiscal notes, some of them zero, some of them big.
All right. I do have one question for Representative Hughes. I'm intrigued by this, and partly it's because 1981 was a long time ago, and I see the need for some adjustments. But on page 2 of the legislative research document, it says, under the proposed structure, a higher percentage of companies fall under the three lowest tax brackets, and that's the point of it, of course. But then it says, overall, however, the tax liability would be more evenly distributed through the middle tax brackets than it is under the current tax structure. I think I'm right that their tax rate, that is, these middle tax brackets, their burden wouldn't be any greater, but as a total of the sum collected, it is greater. Is that? I think that's what that says.
That's true. That is the way I read it.
Okay. And should we have any concern about these folks who are in this middle zone between, you know, the mom-and-pop store and Exxon? I mean, is there any reason to be concerned about that?
I think that, you know, it is graduated, so, you know, the lower ones are going to see the greatest benefit in percentages, and that's why. But I think that it's reasonable, and by expanding them, they're definitely going to be better off under this than the current structure.
Thank you.
And, you know, for the record, we know that Exxon's paying taxes.
Right. Yes.
Significantly. I would not want their tax bill. I think it would break me. With that, I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Representative Chenault. Sure. Just in time for questions. Seeing none, well, this is probably time to go on to the Anchorage LIO or wherever Joanna Bales and Robin Wilson are calling from. Are they both online still, or the same place, or different?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chairman.
Greetings. I think this is the first time you've testified before us this year, but welcome back, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we've got several questions for you.
All right. For the record, my name is Joanna Bales. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division, and I'll go ahead and have Robin introduce herself for the record.
And this is Robin Wilson. I'm the Corporate Income Tax Manager for the Tax Division.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I think we probably just picked up a couple more questions when they heard your title. So, Representative Johansson.
Joseph.
I'm having a tough time with names today.
Looking around.
Well, I'm trying to remember what it is I asked. I asked about the fiscal note. And I think I know the answer to that. So I don't really have a question right now for the division.
You had a question on the $3.8 million.
I did, but I think, Mr. Chairman, you're a great teacher, and you explained that to me. Mm-hmm. The cost of administrating this, Ms. Bales, is zero, and therefore we have a zero fiscal note, even though the impact is $3.8 million. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. It wouldn't cost us any more to administer this tax if the brackets change.
I have a question.
Representative Millett.
Thanks. Ms. Bales, this C-Corp tax is different than the way we tax oil and gas. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, the tax rates for both oil and gas corporations and other non-oil and gas corporations are the same. It's the calculation of the taxable income that differs between oil and gas companies and other non-oil and gas corporations. So this particular piece of legislation would affect oil and gas companies and other non-oil and gas companies the same.
Okay.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be obvious, and I'm missing it, and if so, I apologize. But so what would be the net? We have seen the net effect of a loss of about $3 million on the non-oil and tax. What is the impact on the oil and tax industry, who are our largest taxpayers?
Well, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the $3.8 million encompasses all Subchapter C corporations, which includes the oil and gas corporations as well. So, we have about 27 oil and gas corporations that file. And under this piece of legislation, no single corporation, well, the maximum benefit for a single corporation would be $5,828. And with those 27 oil and gas corporate tax filers, the maximum benefit to all oil and gas corporations under this legislation would be approximately $157,000 in tax savings. So the majority of the savings will go to those non-oil and gas corporations under this bill.
Non-oil, yes. Okay, thanks. That's a quick answer.
Any further questions? Oh, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, thank you for taking my questions. I have a few here. First of all, if you can explain a C again to us, say a C corporation, and what type of businesses typically apply. Is this normally restaurants or just a real major overview of this? And then who investigates if there is potential local tax fraud, who would be the person who investigates that?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, all companies, any company, regardless of the industry that they're engaged in, can be a subchapter C corporation. That designation is within the Internal Revenue Code under, you know, the IRS. So if a company is a C corporation, they are taxed in Alaska by virtue of being a C corporation. The other type of corporations, such as S corporations and limited liability corporations, they are taxed differently federally, and therefore they're taxed differently in the state. So, for instance, with S corporations, the income that's earned is distributed to the individual shareholders and then reported on their individual income tax returns. And the reason that S corporations aren't taxed in Alaska is because we don't have an individual income tax. So that's why they escape the, you know, any taxation to that type of an entity. But as I said, all, any industry, any company that sets itself up as a corporation can be a C corporation or an S corporation, depending upon how they want to be treated under the federal law. There are some other limitations. For instance, under S corporations, you can't have more than 100 shareholders. So these small businesses generally do tend to be S corporations because they don't have to pay the Alaska corporate income tax. But a lot of them, we've noticed, a lot of the older C corporations are companies that have been around for a long time. We do see a lot of mom-and-pop restaurants, airlines, construction companies, retailers. We have some tourism companies that are established as C corporations that have been around for a long time that are subject to Alaska's corporate income tax.
Okay. And in regards to that, if there was local tax for the last part of that question, and then I hope Representative Millett asks hers why we have 10, you know, or more brackets rather than just 3 or 4 or 5.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. I mean, as far as the brackets go, there wasn't discussion from either one of the bill sponsors, SB 7 or this particular bill, to make those brackets, you know, to collapse them into less brackets. So we didn't have that discussion. I think it's a point well taken. And then I guess you also had a question about who investigates.
Correct.
Any type of tax fraud, and that would be us through audits, and then also we do have a criminal investigations unit. So if we receive tips and if anyone has concerns that people aren't properly reporting the income that they've earned, we will investigate.
Okay, and I appreciate that because I called the IRS a few times. I've seen it over my life, but I got nothing back from them. So maybe I called the wrong people. It'd be your department, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I'm not sure when you talk about something rung up at a till. As far as, are you saying that the total purchase wasn't rung up, or that you weren't charged like an additional like sales tax?
No, basically what I've seen happen a few times is, like, let's say, let's just give an example of nails, you know, being done. Let's say it costs $40. You give $40 to them cash, and then you do not get a receipt back. And when you look in the till on the, you know, how much they rang up, it shows zero. So, you know, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. It's just I've noticed it a few times, and it raised alarm to me. So I had called the IRS, and I'm just wondering, is that the appropriate person if any person in the state suspects potential fraud?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. Yeah, when you see that, we would appreciate a call, and then we can determine whether or not that company itself is actually subject to tax. I mean, if they're not a C corporation, they wouldn't be subject to tax. We could refer it on to the IRS because it sounds like they would be trying to avoid individual income tax at that point. But it is something we would be interested in. And there could also be a local sales tax associated with that. I know Anchorage doesn't have one, but there are several jurisdictions throughout the state that do levy a sales tax. So it would be, we would appreciate receiving that type of information.
Paul?
Thank you.
We had a question from Representative Heron, who had to step out for a few minutes, and he was wondering if, although this is a pretty short bill, if there might be any unintended consequences buried in it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, as far as that question goes, we don't see any unintended consequences or potential loopholes. This is actually pretty straightforward.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. So is there a preference from the Department of Revenue on having 10 brackets instead of, you know, doing less brackets like other states do, the smaller bracketed with higher, lower rates and higher on the end? So we just have three or four rather than having 10. Is that something that the Department of Revenue has looked at? Or
through the chair, Representative Millett, we don't have a preference either way. We're already set up for 10 brackets. So to change the amounts within those brackets, I mean, doesn't cause us any additional work or so it really comes down to a preference for legislators and taxpayers. But in our mind, we're so used to administering it this way that it doesn't cause us any concern.
And follow up?
Is it going to ask if it's going to generate a fiscal note?
Pardon?
No.
No.
I'll ask that one.
Okay.
Then.
So I guess it doesn't create a burden for you to continue with the 10 brackets, but would it be easier for the taxpayer if there was less brackets?
Through the chair, Representative Millett. Probably, I don't think it creates any additional burden for them either. We have so many automated tax services, tax preparation services, and that do those calculations automatically. Actually, there would be probably, well, even with this change in the tax brackets and the amounts within them, there would be some software companies that might have to make some changes to their programs, and it would be the same if they collapsed it down into three brackets. So I think at this point in time, just because we've had this for so long in these 10 brackets, I don't really see it as being an issue. However, I mean, I could understand if someone wanted to look at it and make that change.
I have one final question. I'm going to steal your thunder.
Okay.
So why wouldn't people just change their articles of incorporation from C to S so they could avoid the tax altogether?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I think, you know, that's actually a question we've kind of kicked around here. And, you know, back when these corporations were established, the individual income tax rates were, the top rate was 55%, which was greater than the top corporate income tax rate. So we believe that they incorporated a C corps because that actually was the cheaper route for them. They paid less tax. They probably, I mean, and I'm just completely making assumptions here, but oftentimes when you have to redo your articles of incorporation, it involves attorney's fees, sometimes accountant fees, and you know, sometimes it's really just going through that process, and people don't like to do that. So we have pondered that ourselves, because we do believe that at any given time, any one of these small C corporations with less than 100 shareholders could easily convert to an S corporation and not pay any Alaska corporate income tax at all. So that's a really good question, and if anyone can figure out the answer to that, we'd be interested as well.
Open a new business.
Representative Josephson, do you have a question?
No, I'm glad that one was asked.
Well, then I'm going to ask one that you got around to.
Okay.
If we switch to three brackets, hypothetically, is that going to generate a fiscal note, or will you not have any problem with your current software?
Mr. Chairman, no, that wouldn't generate a fiscal note. We could easily convert to less tax brackets.
And at 65% that you mentioned, we're getting pretty close to aces with that, aren't we? You don't have to respond to that.
No comment, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for the Department of Revenue? Seeing none, I think you are off the hook temporarily. Is there anybody else online? Well, I think we'll open it up to the room. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, What are the wishes of the committee?
I move 28LS0306 version A from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, this bill will move out of committee, and we will take a brief at ease. And for anybody that's listening, we've had bills with titles longer than this bill already this year. It's a pretty simple bill. And again, we'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. It is now 4:02. Last bill on the calendar today is House Bill 9, Secure Transactions and Fund Transfers. The bill is being presented by Representative Max Gruenberg and at least one staff member. Miles? Miles Brooks?
Yes, sir.
Welcome, gentlemen. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Max Gruenberg. I represent House District 14, which is Boniface and Russian Jack, next to Representative Josephson's district, and not far from yours, and not far enough from some of your others.
And Miles Brooks, staff to Representative Gruenberg.
Should we hold this bill over?
Please don't.
I have a few amendments.
May I start?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a bill that is a very important bill. It actually covers two subjects, and they're time critical. They amend the Uniform Commercial Code, the first two sections help the banking industry, and the last sections deal with helping creditors who are trying to collect debts from people who change their names or may not always give the correct names. And these are debts that are justly owing. But with people's computers and everything now, it's awfully easy to have a misspelling or something like that, and that can absolutely stop the process. And we have people from the Commissions on Uniform State Laws. They're on the phone and here. By the way, I'd like to thank Mr. Brooks for all of his work on the bill. He's done a lot of work on this. And we introduce this at the request of the commissioners. Ms. Deborah Baer, who's the chair of the Alaska delegation to the Commissioners on Uniform Laws, she's here to testify, and she'll get into the details of the bill. Then we have Professor Bill Henning on the line from the University of Alabama School of Law, who's an expert on the UCC. We have to answer questions Ms. Vicki Backus from the Department of Natural Resources, because they are involved in one section of the bill. They have to help implement it. Mr. Luke Fanning, who's seated here in the first row, representing the Alaska Bankers Association, and Ms. Stacy Schubert from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and they will testify in support of the bill. We have a letter from the governor supporting the actually it's from Michael Garrity on behalf of the administration. From Deborah Baer on behalf of the administration supporting the bill. And there's a July 1 deadline that all states have to meet so that these provisions involving creditors' rights will go into effect simultaneously across the country.
So is this part of a compact? Is this part of a compact?
No. It's not part of a compact. The first two sections of the bill deal with a problem that was created when Dodd-Frank legislation a few years ago was passed. They did not cover certain types of transfers, financial transfers, between banks and individuals. And as a result, the states are having to cure that defect with state law. And the last parts of the bill deal with the problems of the people changing names. And with that, I will yield, with this chair's permission, to Ms. Baer and Professor Henning, and I would request that any technical questions be given to them, because they'll give you the correct answer rather than ignorant from me.
So I believe this is the first time Max has been before the committee.
So far.
So far.
I hope not the last.
I didn't say the last. No.
Yeah, this year. Yeah.
Yeah.
And no, I mean seriously, I'm happy to try to answer the questions, but if you have technical questions, they're the better people.
Is Max going to walk us through the section?
No, Ms. Bear will.
Oh, okay.
And...
Welcome, Max.
Thank you very much.
Oh, both, or, yeah. I'm challenged by names today, believe me.
Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Bear, and I'm employed by the Alaska Department of Law, and I'm chair of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegations. The Alaska statutes assign to the Department of Law the duty to promote uniform laws in Alaska, where uniformity among the states is important. The state of Alaska has been a member of the Uniform Law Commission for over 100 years. It's a states' rights organization where states propose to state legislatures uniform solutions to common problems where uniformity across state lines is desirable. One of these areas is commerce. Businesses frequently buy and sell products and borrow money for their capital needs across state lines. All 50 states have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code. Alaska has done that as well. The Uniform Commercial Code ensures reliability and predictability of business transactions. The goal of this bill is to update two articles of the Uniform Commercial Code. The first one is the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 9 on secure transactions. The easiest way to explain secure transactions is my husband and I are buying a car right now, and very few people pay cash for a car. You put a down payment on it, the bank gives you a loan for the rest of it, but they take a secured interest in the car, because if you do not pay, they want to have an easy way to get that car back. And the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 9, sets up that easy way to take a secured transaction back, the car that they loaned me the money for, that I promised to pay, and how everybody else knows that I don't own much interest in this new car is you perfect it by filing it with the state recorder's office, and so that a secondary creditor who is interested in whether I have any interest in this money in the car, they can look at it and say, no, Deborah doesn't own much of this car, I don't want another dime on it. And so that's what the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9 secured transactions is about. What we've noticed in the years since it's been in practice in the states is it's extremely easy to misspell somebody's name on a secured transaction. For example, the car that I'm buying, it's a bank that's typing it up. It's very easy to misspell Deborah Bear. There's about three or four different ways to spell Deborah, many different ways to spell Bear. If it doesn't match up, the creditor's got a problem. And that shouldn't really be the creditor's problem, because I promised to pay for this. I got a car. And if I don't, I promise that he could get the car back. So it causes a problem if the names don't match. But under current law right now, if the creditor gets get exactly right, there's no problem. The creditor doesn't buy himself a lawsuit, they can get the car back, no problem. It's easy to do. But with a misspelling, it's been a problem. So what the Uniform Law Commissioners are recommending to all the states is let's have a safe harbor, at least the option that we've selected for Alaska, where you look at my driver's license. State of Alaska driver's license, and if the creditor goes that extra step, and even if my driver's license has a misspelling on it, the creditor's fine. The creditor has done everything they can do to protect their interest in that car. If for example, I was a commercial driver's license for bus driving or whatever, and I had a regular driver's license, you take the most current license that I have. If I have an Alaska state identification card and Alaska driver's license, you take the driver's license. So it's a pretty easy way for creditors for businesses to get their expectations fulfilled. And that's what you want in business, for it to go fast, smooth for everybody. You don't want to buy lawsuits when you make a simple transaction like buying a car or something like that. So that's what the first major change is. The second one does with a change in what is called registered organizations. Since the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9 secure transaction was adopted in Alaska and many other states, there's been a whole bunch of different kinds of new limited liability corporations, limited partnerships, things like that. And you have to figure out, in the same thing, these people borrow money too, these limited liability companies. Where do you file their statements? Because they could, in fact, do business in several different states. Well, this sets up a rule and makes it similar to corporations, where you look at their paperwork of organization. Where have they formed? Then that's the state you file in. That's the state you perfect in. And so it makes it much easier for banking to feel more comfortable loaning businesses money. And that's one of the advantages of the Uniform Commercial Code, is if a bank feels more secure that you are going to pay it back, you're either going to get a better interest rate, or you're going to get more ability to get liquid cash that you need to run your business. So that's what the Article 9 is about. The final major change in Article 9 has to deal with what is called after-acquired property. And the easiest way to explain that is, if I was in Anchorage and I wanted to do a bike construction business, I go to my bank and I say, could you loan me some money for a bike construction business? I'm going to go buy parts. I'm going to put together bikes. And the bank will say, that's a great idea. I want to take a security interest in those parts and bikes. And so what we noticed is that businesses don't always stay where they originally intend to be. They cross state lines. And so, for example, my bike business in Anchorage, I may figure in the wintertime for my business, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to stay in Anchorage. Let's move to Arizona for a couple months and go down there with my bikes and my business. And in the process, I take that proceeds that the bank gave me, and I go down and buy more bikes. Well, there's been a legal issue as to Where does a creditor look to see where that statement have to be filed? And under the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9, this new change, it says the filing in Alaska trails with that property to Arizona, in my example, for 4 months, to give the bank 4 months to go down to Arizona to record against those bikes. So it's to make commerce move more smoothly, and it's to make people feel more comfortable loaning money. The final changes, and it's the one that's supported by the Alaska Bankers Association with the letter in your file, deals with remittance transfers, which are electronic transfers generally overseas. The way the law has been set up is, if it's a consumer transaction, it's generally handled under federal law. If it is a business transaction, it's generally handled under state law. There is a recent change in Congress where it kind of muddled up the area, and the banks are asking nationwide for clarity in this area to make sure that things that were covered by the Uniform Commercial Code Article 4A continue to be covered by Uniform Commercial Code 4A for these very minor big money transactions, but the remittance transfers. 30 states have adopted the Article 9 changes, so we are right in with the wave, and all states are supposed to have it by July 1st. 13 more states it's pending before. The Article 4A changes are brand new, and there's a few states that are doing it, but we're all trying to do it very fast because the banking community really, really wants this change. People online that can help us with questions, and Representative Grunberg ran through them. I am not, the one I wanted to point you to most is Bill Henning, who is online from the University of Alabama. He's a nationwide expert in the Uniform Commercial Code. He's written several books, and I'm really honored that he could be with us today. And I have to tell you this, he is not charged in the state of Alaska fees, so I'm really pleased about that.
We'll be getting to him in a minute, but I've got one for you. Is this mod law? Are all the states?
All the states are doing it, and that's an excellent question through the chair, is because with changes, we try to keep pretty much to that uniform law.
And how many states are going to be?
30 have done the Article 9 provisions that are in the bill.
Representative Billette.
Thanks. So I was just reading why the state should adopt the 2010 amendments, and one of the things it says when you're talking about having a driver's license as a form of ID, one of the warnings on the why should be adopted is making sure that our DMV has communication with the uniform code database so that they can speak to each other. Is that what we have in Alaska? Are we
Through the chair, that's an excellent question. We were given two options in the state. One is to have our computers at DMV talk directly to the state recorder. That was not feasible at this time without a significant fiscal note. So we took that instruction to heart and went to the safe harbor, which is looking at somebody's actual physical driver's license. It's not going to be done electronically. It's going to be done in the individual creditor's office.
Hello.
So what if they don't have a driver's license?
If they don't have a driver's license, you go to their individual name. So like my case, if they get Deborah Bear, they get it right, no problem. If they can always get a state ID, it's quite reasonably priced. But most people you'll find It works well with just the regular name, and paperwork works fine. It's only if there's a typo, a mistake in it. And it's not, I really want to stress, it doesn't have to be fraud. Anybody can make a typographical error in a security agreement. And you just want business to move smoothly.
Yeah, and just, Bob, I mean, people mess up my name all the time.
Yeah.
Two R's, one S, two T's,
yeah.
one L. I mean, so, I mean, if I didn't have a driver's license, it happens to me all the time. It's happened on banking documents several times.
Well, then the creditor, first of all, there's, and I should probably have Mr. Henning talk a little bit more about this, but if everybody is acting appropriately, like if I was in, like on my car, I couldn't pay the car, my first step would be to the bank or to the car dealer and say, I can't make these payments. How can we deal with this? The recording function with the name is good for when another creditor wants to try to loan me money, so that he or she can look on that in the database at the state recorder's office and make sure that I don't have a whole bunch of debt all over the state, and therefore I don't have any money to pay off any of my debts. But it doesn't stop the transaction because your name is misspelled. It just makes it more difficult and more expensive.
I guess my only question would be, I'm just thinking about rural Alaska on the driver's license issue. It's and state IDs. I mean, we don't have pictures and machines out in all of our communities, so I don't know how that affects our friends and neighbors out in the bush, but
we'll certainly find out after July 1st.
Yeah, we sure will.
Representative Reinbold, followed by Representative Schnell.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the fiscal note, and then the page 2 of 2 on the fiscal note. The third sentence down, well, it says section 34. It says instruct DNR to adopt, amend, or repeal regulations, and this takes effect immediately. Can you just explain how DNR is impacted there?
If that's a DNR fiscal note, I have a representative from DNR online that could probably address it better than I did. I drafted the one for the Department of Law, and I don't remember that sentence being in my fiscal note.
Okay, and we have?
It would be the state recorder through the chair.
Who do we have online? Oh, from the recorder's office. Vicki Backus, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I sure am.
Did you catch that question? Or would you like to table?
Through the chair, the instruction to DNR to adopt, amend, or repeal, I'm not sure that I follow the question. Once this bill is approved, we've got some minor changes that we'll be making to our regulations, but mostly it's to amend our form.
Ms. Backus, could you state your name and affiliation for the record, please?
I'm sorry, it's Vicki Backus. I'm the state recorder.
Oh, thanks. Follow up?
Okay, so basically, I'm reg review chair, and that's why I'm just wondering if I'm going to get a whole bunch of emails and a whole bunch of paperwork in regards to this. It just was alarming to me that this even impacts DNR, and that's, you know, why I decided to bring this to your attention, because it's a pretty big department.
Through the chair, it really is going to be minimal as far as DNR's involvement, because it's mostly just updating some forms that we're going to be doing internally.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Yes, from Ms. Baird, you said 30 states have opted into the recommendations, and my question is, what about the 4A recommendations? How many states have done that?
Through the chair, less states have, but it's not because they have any problems with them. They've only been out in the industry for legislature to adopt for several months. So I think it's 3 or 4. It's not, but there are many pending before the states. And the banking community is pretty much, they think it's a very good idea.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to remember my question now. I knew it wasn't that important.
You're having the same kind of day.
Well, we go back and you were talking about a loan on your car, and you would do this or you would do that. Does a misspelling of the name actually have anything to do with repossessing of the car? From the bank standpoint or from the creditor standpoint?
The only way it would be is if you had to go into court and prove that you had the same Deborah Bear, that you were going after the same Deborah Bear's car. But if there was no objection to it, the debtor didn't make any objection to it, I think it would go pretty smoothly through the courts.
But and Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would think that the bank is or the creditor is loaning the money on the vehicle, for instance. They're going after the VIN number on the vehicle. They're not particularly looking at who owns it. Or I wouldn't be if I was the creditor. I would be going after to make sure that I got the right vehicle. I might be concerned that their name was misspelled, but my main concern would be that I had the right vehicle.
Representative Joseph?
Well, just a comment. I mean, before this comes to the floor, I'd like to look at it a little bit more, but this strikes me, Ms. Baird, as clearly for creditors and not debtors, but at the same time, it doesn't strike me that there's anything unreasonable in here. Is that how you see this?
Through the chair, I think it's also a debtor's bill, because I can tell you, if I went to a car dealer and they did not have an easy way to get that car back if I didn't pay, they'd be very reluctant to give me that car. And so it makes credit easier for consumers. And a question that I've been asked is, has any consumer group raised any objections about this? No. Nationwide, and it's been through 30 states.
Hello? Any further questions? Well, I think we'll start in the room. Thank you very much. In the room, we've got so many people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I wonder if we have Professor Hill on the line from Alabama.
Oh, certainly. He's probably about 3 hours off, 4 hours off. Are you with us?
Yes, this is Bill Henning, and it's an honor to be here. I've been listening to the conversation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
And I believe you've been involved in previous bills that we've had with you, or with Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, sir, that's correct. I have, in fact, in the past, and I am not just with the Alabama Law School, but I'm also a uniform law commissioner and have worked extensively with Ms. Baer on the commission.
We had you down for testimony, but are you, your questions only then? Obviously, you support the bill.
Well, I will be happy to make some brief comments at your pleasure, sir.
I think you got off early.
Would you like me to go? I'm sorry. Would you like me to go ahead and
We do have a last question. Representative Reinbold.
Okay. I guess since you've been waiting, I'll go ahead and ask you a question. There's 30 states apparently that have adopted this Article 9. And I'm wondering, the 20 states that have not, do you have any idea why not? I know there's 13 pending, but why would the reasons not to adopt this be? And the second is, are there any national organizations such as NCSL or anything like that that have weighed in on this on one side or the other?
I'm glad to answer that. The amendments were finalized by the Uniform Law Commission and the co-sponsor, the American Law Institute, just in 2010, and as Ms. Baer testified, the idea is that we want these to come online, if you will, at the same time across the nation. And so we've gone out to the states, and those states that have adopted it in prior years, we asked them to defer the effective date until July 1, 2013. As Ms. Baer testified, we have 30 states so far. I am aware of many more than 13 states. I don't want to say all 20 states that perhaps have not dropped the legislation in yet this session, but are preparing to do so. It's my understanding and firm belief that we will have universal adoption in all 50 states. There is no opposition to it anywhere that I'm aware of. And with regard to the consumer organizations, When I was on the drafting committee that prepared the Article 9 amendments, and we had on the committee someone from the Consumers Union, who is now with the Federal Consumer Finance Protection Board, the new board, and she was involved every step along the way. She's an expert in the Uniform Commercial Code itself, serves on the permanent editorial board for the Uniform Commercial Code, and found no problem with this and did not think, and in fact did some work and reported back that this idea of moving to a driver's license name as a safe harbor to give additional certainty to creditors would not disadvantage anyone who did not have a driver's license, because there are other ways to show the name that would be perfectly adequate. So there's no opposition. There's no opposition from consumer groups. And with regard to the 20 states that have not yet acted, it's just that this has happened quickly in a three-year period, and I believe they will act very promptly.
Follow.
Okay, so just you know, a note of caution, if this has been passed in 30 states, has there been any unintended consequences in any of these 30 states that you're aware of?
No, there have been no unintended consequences that I'm aware of, but bear in mind that it's not effective in those states until July 1, 2013. But this has been very carefully gone over by the commissioners, as I indicated, consumer groups, by banking groups, and I don't believe that there are any problems here. I lecture nationwide giving continuing legal education presentations on these amendments, and have presented them in a number of states to groups of lawyers, and have not yet been asked a question that leads me to believe that there's a problem.
Okay, and I got permission for a follow-up. So none of these people are initiating this, none of these states, until July 1st, 2013, and is that, why did you choose that effective date?
We chose that effective date because if different states have this effective at different times, if, for example, states that adopted it in 2011 made it immediately effective, then you have some states with the amendments and some states without the amendments. And what that creates is a conflict of laws problem, where there's uncertainty as to which state's law governs in certain situations. And if it's state A, it's the new amendments, and if it's state B, it's the old law. And so in order to avoid that kind of uncertainty, we thought the best approach would be to defer effectiveness across the board until July 1, 2013. I might add that these amendments are to a large-scale revision of Article 9 that was adopted in put out by the sponsors in about 1998 or 1999, and we went through a process then of getting that large package of changes through the states, and we selected a deferred effective date of July 1, 2001. So we've done this before, and it worked very well that time, and all 50 states adopted. And the pattern of adoption then was about the same as the pattern of adoption now. In other words, going into the last year, we had about 30 states, and every other state came on board.
Thank you.
Follow-up? Well, thanks again, Commissioner. Any further questions? Nope. Thanks again for joining us, and good luck. I was especially good enough to get this thing fired up by July 1st. I think I might add that we get a bill like this every year or two that where the whole country will have an effective date of July 1st for the reasons that he outlined. It can be insurance or it can be banking, but it's common if it's being done nationally to have everybody start on the same day.
Well, it was an honor to be there, and I'm excused now. No, there will be no further questions, sir.
Yep, you can go home. Oh, Representative Grunberg would like to add something. Please join us.
Mr. Henning, this is Max Grunberg. Am I correct that the general rule is stated And this is for the folks here on page 8 of the bill, lines 11 through 7 through 18, where they're talking about the name of a debtor if it's an individual. The financing statement must provide either the individual name of the debtor, the surname and the first personal name of the debtor, or subject to G, which I'll get to in a minute, the name of the individual that's on an unexpired driver's license that this state, Alaska, has issued, or an unexpired identification card issued to the individual under the laws of Alaska. And under sub G, if there is more than one driver's license, this is on page 9, more than one identification card, or both an identification card and a driver's license, the license or card that was issued the most recently is the one that controls. So this is all very carefully set out. Am I correct in that interpretation?
Yes, sir. It is very carefully set out, and if you'd like me to explain any of the reasoning behind it, I'll be glad to, but you've correctly stated how the rules work.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks again. Representative Gruenberg, we have a question for you on page 9.
Well, we were on page 9, and I'm not meaning to get into the weeds too deeply, but on line 24, 27, and 30, if you can just explain the financing statement becoming seriously misleading. I mean, it's just a repeat over and over in that. What was the entire point of that section?
I'm going to defer to Professor Henning on that one. I'll take a look.
Yes, I'll be glad to answer that one. We have a couple of situations. For example, if there is a loan to a decedent's estate, which would be you'd think it would be a rare circumstance, but frequently, if there is a deceased person, there needs to be an infusion of capital to keep businesses going while you go through a winding up process, and so the name that you use on the financing statement in that situation, because you want searchers to be able to find this. So the name that you use is actually the name of the deceased person, and yet the deceased person is obviously not the debtor in the transaction. It's the estate itself. And so all we're saying here is that we're changing it so that if it says a filed financing statement, the name that a filed financing statement provides for a debtor becomes insufficient. In that situation, there's not a name change. The rule previously talked in terms of names changing to become seriously misleading, but that doesn't accurately describe all the situations. So this is nothing other than a technical change. The content of the rule remains exactly the same. There's no change in the substantive law. This language is just more descriptive.
Okay, that's really helpful. And so is this law identical to what is in other states?
This law is precisely identical to what is in all of the 30 states that have adopted the 2010 amendments to Article 9, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Any further questions for...
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Baer, we didn't make any substantive. This is exactly the Uniform Act, is it not?
Yes. For the record, this is Deborah Baer. There were some stylistic changes, commas and things like that, but I ran the draft by the national headquarters, and they said, yes, it meets the test of uniformity, and it would be accepted as all other the states have been accepted.
And I can vouch for that. This is the first version. By now, we should have been on the third version.
Oh.
So there have been no changes. With us in the room, I believe we have Luke Banning. Welcome, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide feedback on this bill. My name is Luke Banning. I'm a vice president for First National Bank Alaska, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Bankers Association. The Alaska Bankers Association represents 8 state, national, and federal savings banks in Alaska. And our member banks are responsible for 85% of the non-public commercial lending in Alaska, as well as 2,500 employees across 130 branches statewide. The Alaska Bankers Association supports House Bill 9 because it provides for necessary amendments to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Article 9 has been adopted in all 50 states, and this legislation is necessary to address recent amendments made to the articles in 2010. The amendments have already been adopted in 30 states, as we've discussed, and similar legislation is pending in several others. It's important that this bill be passed this session because the amendments will be effective July 1st, 2013. If the bill is not passed this year, this session, then Alaska will be inconsistent with the amendments already adopted in the majority of these states. The bottom line is that this bill is necessary to keep Article 9 up to date and to ensure that Alaska law is consistent with financial practices in the rest of the country. Failure to pass it could result in additional costs and uncertainty for Alaska businesses and financial services customers. And I'll just note quickly that a lot of the discussion is surrounded creditors, but it also affects other businesses and parties trying to purchase property, particularly across state lines. If there is an inconsistency in the security requirements, it could hinder or otherwise uphold property sales transfers and other things, such as a car being purchased across state lines or others. So it's not just limited to creditors, but it affects the people purchasing these assets and trying to sell these assets as well, regardless of whether a bank is involved in that transaction. Thank you for your time and your consideration of the Alaska Bankers Association's position on this bill. Thank you.
I've got at least one question, and the first one would be, what would happen if we have 45 states and you have a multi-state relationship with a state that's not party to the agreement by July 1st?
That could complicate things, particularly in the event of foreclosure or the sale of an asset, or if you, for example, were a private party trying to either buy or sell an asset across state lines. If the UCC codes were inconsistent, it could, could hinder your transaction, or it could derail your ability to get financing on that asset if the chain of ownership weren't clear and consistent.
But if you only need a majority of the states by July 1st, you may end up in a situation where you don't have all 50, obviously. I mean, you have 30 right now. You've got everybody else looking at it. But what happens at that point? You're just wary of doing business or trying not to do business with a that would involve that state? Or?
Well, I would defer to Mrs. Baer on that one with regard to some of the other implications. I do know that if there was any perception whatsoever that it could drive up costs or otherwise hinder the bank's ability to lend or collect on those assets, it would only drive up our costs, which would have to be allocated for by some other mechanism, or it could discourage lending in a worst-case scenario.
Any further questions? Thanks again for being here today. And
thank you very much.
Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill?
We have Ms. Schubert from AHS.
She's not in the room. She's on the phone. Or unless, is she hiding back there? I think we've got everybody at Alaska Housing except for Dan Fowski, but we'll go to Anchorage right now. Is Stacy, are you there?
Good afternoon, Chairman Olson. This is Stacy Schubert.
Well, welcome to the committee, Stacy. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you, Chairman Olson. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Schubert, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. AHSC, through its multifamily lending department, utilizes Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code in securing some of its collateral when financing multifamily projects. The collateral, such as kitchen appliances, furniture, equipment, and the like, is perfected through the recording of a UCC financing statement. As proposed, House Bill 9 further enhances AHFC's, as well as other creditors' secured positions by providing, one, greater guidance as to the name of the debtor that is to be provided on the financing statement, and two, greater protection for an existing secured creditor having a security interest in an after-acquired property when the debtor moves to another state or merges with another entity. For example, in the event AHFC forecloses on a property and is also trying to repossess and sell the furniture and appliances, the amendments to UCC 9 would protect AHFC in the event the debtor has merged with another entity after the loan has closed. AHFC supports the revisions as they enhance AHFC's ability to repossess its security. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. Any questions for Stacy? Thanks again, Stacy. We have two other people from Alaska Housing signed up. Paul Kapinski, are you with us?
Mr. Kapinski and Mr. Buller are both with me, sir. They're just available for questions.
Oh, okay. Any questions for Alaska Housing? Nope. I got one for Dan Fowsky. When are you coming back?
He will be there next week, Mr. Chairman.
We're working on something for him. We hope we see him. Thanks.
I will pass that message along.
Anybody else online? There were questions online?
Yeah.
We have two other recorders that had indicated there were questions only, Paula Kelsey and Mary Ellen Beardsley. Any questions? Are they still there?
This is Polly Kelsey. I have no other questions.
Well, thank you for being
here. Mary Ellen Beardsley. I'm with the Department of Law, and I'm here for questions.
Any questions for law? And nobody else online? I'd love to move this today, but I think with four people, I feel.
I can go get that if you want.
We'll take a break at ease. We're back on the record, and is there anybody in the room that hasn't had a chance to testify that cares to testify? Seeing none, nobody online? Close out public testimony, bring it back to the committee. Any questions for the sponsor? Last minute questions? Any questions for the speaker?
Where were you?
I'm going to try.
And I knew if we waited long enough, we'd have
everybody. Sorry, I had a constituent come in.
What are the wishes of the committee?
I move House Bill 6828 LS 28. I move House Bill 928 LS 0035 version N from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Object.
Call for the vote.
I remove my objection.
Okay. Seeing no, is there any further objection? What do you think?
Come on.
Seeing no further objection, we'll move the bill out of committee with attached fiscal note and no amendments.
Correct.
And, pardon me?
Individual recommendations.
And individual recommendations, which is that we adjourn.
Okay.